Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Sometimes conventional wisdom can be stood on its head, and that happened to me when I read the article under the following headline: "We've got the connection between coal and addiction backwards, researchers say." And one of those researchers, Gilbert Metcalf, is joining us now from Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, where he teaches economics. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Metcalf.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
So am I correct that you worked on this research in collaboration with the University of Southern California economist Chi-Tung Wang?
I did. Chi-Tung at the time was a master's student in our department here at Tufts University, and he's now gone on to become a PhD student at USC.
I came across this article about your work in the Daily Yonder, and as it says in the lead, the assumption has long been that people turn to drugs when they lose their jobs. But in the matter of coal mining, you found evidence that it was the presence of coal mining jobs themselves that helped create the opioid epidemic that we're experiencing here, not their absence. Is that correct?
That's right. There are really two forces going on here. If you like, I could go through them.
Yes, please.
There is this sort of commonly understood notion that poor economic conditions have led to increased deaths due to drug addiction. This is the whole so-called deaths of despair idea. And that's certainly true. But the other thing going on is that coal mining, especially underground coal mining, is an exceedingly dangerous, hazardous occupation with high injury rates. And so that right there could lead to more usage and potential addiction to opioids.
What sort of data did you uncover that supports the finding that pain from working in the mines, not layoffs, has led to opioid addiction?
So we pulled together two different data sets. We pulled together county-level data on opioid mortality from the National Center of Health Statistics, and we merged that with data on individual we had data on every single coal mine in the United States, which we then pulled together at the county level. And so what we did was we simply asked, if you have more of the local workforce in a county involved in coal mining, do you see deaths from opioid use going up or going down? And what we found is that in all of our ways of cutting the data, the death rate went up when there's more coal mining activity.
Your findings run so directly counter to what has been a widely held assumption in this area, at least, that the addiction is directly related to, as you said earlier, the despair that follows job loss, with bills piling up, mouths to feed, a sense of helplessness. If there is pushback on this notion, I'm sure we'll hear about it. Have you?
I have not.
That's interesting. Opioid prescription rates in this area, in Appalachia, are just about double the rates in other regions. Addiction to pain medications has long been a priority topic of discussion in and around the coalfield communities of eastern Kentucky. In light of your findings, how would you recommend policymakers perhaps adjust their approach to this epidemic?
Let me just say before I answer that question, your statistic about the heavy prevalence of opioid use and death rates in Appalachia relative to the rest of the country is completely consistent with our results, because what we're looking at is what happens in a county when you change the reliance on coal mining. So you could imagine that opioid addictions are higher in Appalachia than the rest of the country, but the right question is what happens when you change the reliance on coal mining? And what we find, again, is that as coal mining declines, we're seeing a bit of a reduction in that mortality rate.
It's kind of an ironic silver lining, isn't it? I mean,
well, I think that's right. I think what this tells us is we know we have a problem, and this is a tough sell in coal mining country, but we know that coal is a has a lot of issues environmentally, whether it's a particulate matter, black lung disease, or climate change. And I know that's a controversial topic in your neck of the woods, but It does say that if we are going to do a national policy to seriously address our use of coal, and to me, a serious policy includes really working closely in Appalachian communities to help them keep their economic vitality alive. That if we do that, we may see some this silver lining, as you say, of reduced deaths from opioids.
Well, what you are presenting here is a very different way of thinking for people in the coal fields, for all of us in eastern Kentucky. It might take some time for people to digest this information, to absorb it, but at the end of that process, what do you think they should do with it?
Well, I hope it will be part of the conversation for how we can think about economic development in eastern Kentucky and other nearby coal mining regions as to where do we want to see these regions going in the next 20 years and what kind of assistance do they need from the national government to do that.
Do you think that your findings also have implications for those who are working in addiction recovery, working with people directly who have been addicted to opioids?
Well, I think it will be interesting news to them, and I think that I'm not sure I want to say it's welcome news to say that this is a silver lining to the extent that coal mining is declining, but I do think that it suggests that perhaps there should be more of a focus on reaching out to coal miners who are working to see if there is anything that could be done to try to avoid overuse and misuse of opioids for working miners.
Dr. Metcalf, I think we have teased our listeners with your findings. I wonder, is there a link or someplace online that they can go to obtain the full report and absorb your information?
Well, they can certainly go to my website, and I can provide you a link to that so they can download the study itself.
Sure. Okay, you can do that, and we'll put it on our website. It'll be available at esweku.com on the facts and information page. Dr. Gilbert Metcalf, a professor of economics at Tufts University, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
There are some important changes happening in the way society regards drug addiction, but it's still very much an uphill battle to work your way from recovery, and often incarceration, back into the workforce with a good job that pays the bills. Let's bring in Rob Perez, who, along with his wife Diane, own Sawgood Restaurants and DV8 Kitchen in Lexington. In the past year, they've developed a series of what they call Soulful Enterprise workshops to teach business owners, community leaders, and nonprofits how to hire, integrate, and retain employees looking for a second chance in life. Thanks for joining us, Rob.
Thank you.
The first of these workshops for 2020 has already been held. You have another coming up in late March. Is this an outgrowth of what's been happening at your DV8 Kitchen location?
It really is. People have been interested and some fascinated with the idea of hiring people, I think because they come in as customers. They see the way that our staff interacts with the customers, and they also taste the bakery and the food products, and I think they're blown away. And so that gets them to contemplate, ask questions, and we've been in the position where many organizations want to hear more on kind of our track record business-wise, really how we do the process, why it seems to be working. And we got so many requests to sit down with people, we thought we'd formalize it a bit and be able to explain it to many people at one time.
So you had a lot of people who experienced it. And by the way, when you're there, you can almost cut the gratitude with a knife among the people who are working there. And so I take it you had a lot of people coming to your door and they liked what they saw and they wanted to see if they could do it in their own businesses.
Yeah, it became a kind of a fun experience to start working with people, but it became so hard to do one-on-one. So we decided to kind of formalize it by working with Jay and Jennifer McCord, who help us put it together. Jay is a great motivational speaker, but he also is a great professional coach. So what happens in these is that I kind of explain what we do, and Jay works with folks in the seminar to try to help people implement it.
So are you, and this goes back to Deviate Kitchen really, but are you seeing success in giving people that second chance?
Yeah, our business results are really exceptional. Our goal is to be 20% better, not only to be able to be competitive in the marketplace, but to try to teach our folks that are in a second chance position how to, you know, figure out how to get a job, how to retain a job, how to get a raise at a job, and hopefully end up in the field that they want.
So let's get back to the workshop that the McCords are leading. What can anybody who signs up for a workshop expect to take away from it?
Well, I think that they're going to walk away understanding what their business, their organization can really do to impact being really a transformational employer, and also to share that word with other people. We try to focus on why we do things, how we do them, and then how can you implement them.
Now, on the Soulful Enterprise website, there is the question, do you struggle with the idea of hiring a second chance employee? And it then lists six additional questions to help find an answer to the first one. So let's look at those. And the first one is, do you think it would cost too much money?
Yeah. So all of those questions probably, they originated from what I thought. I mean, the whole idea of Deviate didn't come from me because I thought too much like a business guy. And I had had bad results trying to hire someone in a second chance position because I didn't know how to think about it, what to do, what should I do different to get different results. But my wife had a giant heart, and she really pushed me to try to figure it all out. But I wasn't smart enough at the beginning of Deviate to do anything different. I did the same old thing, the same old way. And then, you know, the necessity breeds invention, right? We were about ready to lose it and completely fold everything up because it was draining so much money. And I had to really take a hard look at what we were doing, and we created a completely different business model in which to do it. And we had to change the way that we hired people, retained them, motivated them completely in order to be able to lower turnover, lower retention rates, you know, figure out really how we can do it all completely different.
I know she was unavailable for this interview, but I hope the next Perez interview involves Diane as well.
Oh, well, she's definitely the brains of the operation.
So another question among those six was, do you think it would cost you too much time?
Yes. Well, I'm not going to tell you that working with people in a second chance takes less time, but I can tell you that the time that you could spend using the model that we've built can be really productive, not only for really the folks that are in a second chance opportunity, but also for an employer. I've learned so much by applying just a simple model of ask five whys when someone doesn't do it right the first time. And you might find that people just don't know. They haven't been exposed to it. Simple questions like, why are you late? Can lead to transportation issues, lead to kids getting sick. I mean, there's a million different reasons, but we think, at least I believe, the business community just thinks that everybody should know really simple answers to really simple business questions. But frankly, there's many people that haven't experienced the good why, and that there can be transparency between a boss and an employee.
This next question is one that I'm sure falls into that category of seeming really difficult, and that is, does it seem hard to integrate?
Yeah. I think that it's harder to integrate when you believe you can't talk about it. And I believe that in general, we should be able to start discussing recovery as opposed to addiction and define it and understand specifically what it means to be in recovery. We've had to build a nomenclature built around this idea. When we talk to people, we want to know that they are in an active program, that they're doing something different by community therapy, by a 12-step program, and even medically assisted treatment. We need to understand that they're committed to being in recovery, staying in recovery, and they understand the processes in which they're applying so that we can support it. We also ask them to sign a HIPAA document that requires them to allow for example, a residential living facility that they might be in, share with us three bits of information. Do they currently have housing? Are they working a program that we just outlined? And are they testing appropriately for drugs and alcohol? If they do that, they give us the ability to hear about that from their social worker or their caseworker. Then we have them sign an employment contract that outlines that we think that it's more important for them to have housing, work a program, and be clean than have a job. But if they do these things and they perform at the job, they always have a job. However, if they don't have a house, aren't working a program, and aren't testing clean, that even if they're the best employee ever, we can let them go.
The next question among these six that came up is, are you concerned for your safety?
Yeah, that came out of the idea that when we first opened up our doors, people did know our message. And frankly, no one showed up. Crickets and tumbleweeds is what we talked about. We weren't attracting people. And when I went to the people I trusted most, some of our old customers, some of our social investors, people in the community, when we were able to strip away all of the, oh, I would never do that, or I don't think that way, I think everybody should deserve a second chance, what we found from our customers was two basic things. Number one, they feared for either their pocketbook or their safety, or they didn't want to mess up a $6 sandwich and 45 minutes. And I understand that. I think we've been programmed to believe that people that are in recovery or in with a past of addiction might not be able to perform in a way that you think is credible. And we might have been programmed that way because of our own experience or because we've gone to other concepts similar to Deviate and we didn't have a good experience. So we had to address that. We had to try to understand that. And we really wanted to kind of figure out how we can combat that.
So you also suggest that somebody who's thinking about doing this asks, is it time to rethink the impact you're having at work? Tell us about that question. What are you asking there?
Again, that comes from our own experience. My wife used my faith to try to question what I did. And it can apply to anybody, whatever faith that you're in, or just you caring about your community. She tried to explain to me that basically what I was doing was all transactional. And what people might need to get out of generational poverty, get a chance after being incarcerated or in recovery, they really needed someone to wrap around them as a relationship, to sit down with people. And frankly, it was really difficult to do that in our personal life. I always felt like I didn't have enough time, have enough money, have enough, I didn't have the energy to do it. So what we found is that at work, we already are programmed to have to mentor people. We already have time that we have to be at our job to supervise people. And frankly, we all have budgets to hire and train people. So when we go and try to give social impact at work, it's funny. It's already programmed there. It's not unnatural. We have margins of time, money, and space within the workforce, within our work environment, but it's very difficult to do it personally. So we kind of just stumbled onto this, and we think that this is something that we should share with folks.
So the final question is kind of provocative. It's something that could also be thrown out to the community as a thought piece, and that is it time to rethink how you give back?
Yeah. So we wonder all the time if we wouldn't have stumbled into this, if we would have ever changed our mind about this. But through action, through really trying to help people and really taking a chance, don't give me any of the credit. Again, it's all Diane. But I think that really what we all need to think about is when we contemplate someone getting out of prison, we always think, well, I hope they pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. And the reality is that I think that we as a society are the ones that are creating recidivism, not necessarily the people that are coming out. We frequently don't give people an opportunity to have a job. And if we do, it's only minimum wage. They can't, unfortunately, even get an apartment in their own name. They can't even, if they have a felony, have any, they don't have any representation.
So much for the bootstraps.
Yeah, there's just nothing to pull up on their own.
Mm-hmm.
If any one of us that have experienced very little poverty in our life or not ever had a brush with the law would have to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, it would be difficult without any kind of help. And, you know, for me, when I went through rehab, I still had a family that was in middle class. I still had not lost my job yet, very close, but I didn't. And I had a network of people. Well, think about if you are you grow up in a place where you don't have any relationships that might help you in the business world. I mean, why wouldn't you go back to prison? Why wouldn't you go back to using? Why wouldn't you go to deal drugs or do something that was illegal for fast money? Because you don't have any other choice. Have you ever, has many of the people that I hang out with ever lived on a minimum wage job and be able to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps? I mean, that's hard.
Especially in today's world.
Yeah.
One of the bullet points under What You Will Learn states how to integrate a triple bottom line. What is that?
Yeah, so me as a business guy, I really only worried about my financial bottom line before DV8. I really cared about making profit, and that's all I focused on. I didn't reflect on anything weekly or monthly like we do on a P&L. And we applied that idea to our social impact. So the second bottom line after financial is social impact. How are we impacting people that are coming from addiction? And we want to evaluate that and spend as much time on that as we do financial. And then our third bottom line is a higher purpose. It could be anybody's higher purpose. We don't go out there and say, hey, everybody should be, you know, have a Christian faith just like us. We just think that there's lots of data out there, secular as well as faith-based, that says, hey, if you have a higher purpose when you wake up at night and you bring it to work, you're happier at your job and you do better too. Lots of data is out there. And we think that if we evaluate not only our higher purpose, but our social impact, as well as our profit, every single day, every single week, and evaluate it and spend the same amount of time as we do currently financially, that our lives are going to be better at work. And the people that we work with are going to be better at work. And our community is going to be better at work. So it's been really unbelievably successful for our mindsets, for our business, for our people. And we hope that we're passing that on to our community a little bit too.
So how can people sign up? Is there a fee for the workshop?
Yeah, there's a fee. It's a one-day shop. You get to eat and we take care of you and serve you all day long. And we do it at a combination of two places, the Saul Good downtown as well as DV8. And you get access to all of our material.
Okay. And listener, if you would like to explore further, you can find more online at events.dv8kitchen.com. Rob Perez, co-owner of Saul Good Restaurants and DV8 Kitchen in Lexington, as well as the Soulful Enterprise Workshops, now teaching business owners, community leaders, and nonprofits how to hire, integrate, and retain second chance employees. Thanks so much for what you're doing, Rob.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up in a moment, Rising Rivers, Too Much Homework, and the latest candidate for conductor of the Lexington Philharmonic. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Serious waterway accidents have been on the rise in recent years in the Ohio River watershed. An investigation by Alexandra Kanick of the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting found that an increase in rain might be part of the problem. Her story is part of Good River, a collaboration about the environment, economy, and culture of the Ohio River.
The Ohio River had risen more than 12 feet in 30 hours, and the icy water was moving fast. As a fleet of 27 barges sat waiting for the right conditions to get towed through the locks and dams near Pittsburgh, big chunks of ice began building up behind them. It was about 6:15 a.m. when a towing vessel captain saw sparks.
They tried to arrange the barges as best they could to prepare for this type of thing.
That's Liam LaRue, chief of the Major Marine Investigations at the National Transportation Safety Board. His unit investigated this incident in 2018.
The weight of the ice was too much and ended up breaking a bunch of barges away.
They sunk, ran aground, or were otherwise damaged. Like most accidents, there were a few factors, faulty equipment, for example, but the biggest reason was the rain. High water makes navigating more challenging, and the NTSB is increasingly pointing to heavy rainfall after shipping-related incidents happen.
You know, we'd get a few accidents a week, and they were all just high water-related.
Over the past decade, federal data show that rainfall has contributed to more serious marine accidents in the Ohio watershed at a time when climate change means more extreme weather. And a KYCIR analysis found more hazardous cargo moving down the Ohio River recently than past years. Dangerous cargo has been an issue before in Louisville. In 1972, much of the Portland neighborhood was evacuated after a barge hauling chlorine gas got lodged in the McAlpin Dam, putting thousands of lives at risk if it had broke.
As a result of this and other frequent casualties, they set up a vessel management system in Louisville.
That's Nick Frischella, director of the Vessel Traffic Service the U.S. Coast Guard runs in Louisville. It's only one of 12 places in the country where the Coast Guard operates this kind of special service to assist with navigation. And it's the only one that's inland. That's because the city's stretch of the Ohio is complicated to navigate. It has narrow bridges and excessive debris. But Frischella says the biggest challenge during high water is the McAlpin Locks and Dam.
Once these increased river levels and currents and velocities pick up, they create a hazardous condition called an outdraft condition, which is actually pulling a vessel that's trying to transit down through the canal there towards the lock and dam. Sometimes they'll catch them off guard if they're not steering it correctly. Or they need the entire channel width to get themselves through there safely.
High water can be so difficult because it actually changes the riverbed, according to Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Tequila Powell.
You get a lot of areas where, you know, silt and mud are pushed up in the area, and that's not usually there. And then a vessel is going down the river and they ground in that area.
There are some resources to help mariners avoid trouble, like 10-day river forecasts and the Coast Guard's local river guides. But these efforts are short-term. Climate change is taking hold now. But when it comes to its effect on river safety, government agencies aren't focused yet on what's coming downstream. For the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, I'm Alexandra Kanick.
This story is part of the series Good River, produced by 7 nonprofit newsrooms in the Ohio watershed region. More stories at ohiowatershed.org. It's very easy to assume that kids are being irresponsible when they fail to keep track of assignments or don't know when an exam is scheduled. And that may be the case for some, but frequently this can be a sign that a child is experiencing academic stress. A 2014 study for the American Psychological Association found that during the school year, teens say their stress level is higher than the levels being reported by adults. And according to Dan Florell, an associate professor of psychology here at EKU, we parents need to be looking more closely for signs of trouble. He's here to talk to us about it. Welcome, Dr. Florell.
It's so good to be here.
So let's sort this out. Irresponsibility about schoolwork is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And academic stress and the body's reaction to challenge also is a real thing.
Sure.
So how can a parent tell the difference?
Well, I think, you know, it's by a process of kind of eliminating the different possibilities. And I think our natural inclination is to automatically think that they're being irresponsible, that they're not stepping up to the plate and doing what they should. And I think a lot of times parents will overlook the fact that sometimes kids just frankly feel overwhelmed. Obviously, there's a lot of high expectation in our schools and for good reason. But for some children where things don't come as naturally, they begin to internalize it. They become anxious. And we know the one thing that anxiety does is it really shuts down the true ability of a child so that things start to fall through the cracks. And all I would ask is, you know, as adults, when we become more stressed, do you start to forget things? Do little things get put off? That's an adult. When you talk about a child or even an adolescent, they have fewer coping mechanisms. They have less life experience and how to deal with this sort of anxiety and high expectations. And so then you begin to see it in the forms of what many interpret as being irresponsible.
And those high expectations can be a good thing, of course. Mm-hmm. But do you think have we generally set our goals a little too high in terms of achievement? Or is that one of the factors that is playing into this stress that kids are feeling?
I think there's certainly a role there. And, you know, when we talk about stress, even though it's typically an academic stress, you certainly also have the stress of a lot of outside activities too. You may have sports travel teams. You may have gymnastics. You may have all these other things that are getting into the time that a child might have to be able to recuperate and yet keep it at a very, very high stress level. So I'm not arguing that good or high expectations are necessarily a bad thing. Some children need to be prompted to strive and push past their level of comfort to really truly achieve. But what I'm saying, there is a select group of students where that is almost the exact opposite of what you want to do. And one of the things parents can do is really they're going to know their child best. Some children are naturally more anxious. Some really embrace challenges. And depending on the type of child you have, you might be able to recognize when they're showing these kind of being academically stressed.
What symptoms. Kind of behaviors or physical symptoms indicate when stress is becoming a problem?
Well, I mean, you certainly have a lot of complaints and reluctance to engage in activities. Like all of us, a little good procrastination can oftentimes be a symptom of anxiety. Things like, oh, I forgot that at school. So even if they didn't mean to forget it at school, it could be a subtle, indirect, unconscious way that they're dealing with the stress because they know if they don't have the materials, then they can't do the actual assignment. And so there's lots of those type of things that you can see in regards to symptoms. They may complain a lot. You may, if you do have the homework, it takes hours to do when it should just take minutes. So those are common symptoms of children that have anxiety or other underlying issues going on.
There's a real art to parenting. And I wonder if you could help us find that sweet spot. Of course, when we're confronted by this kind of situation with our child, we want to help. We want to help them find their way through it. At the same time, we don't want to overly pamper them.
Right.
Where is the equilibrium between those two forces?
Well, I think there's a bit of trial and error, and I think one of the things we always need to give parents is a little bit of permission to not be perfect. Even if you have multiple children, you're not going to be able to parent in the same way. And one of the first steps you can do is just reach out to the school. I find often that sometimes homeschool communication is somewhat lacking, and sometimes teachers can give some nice insight to whether it's an academic stress issue or if there may be some other issues going on. And so that can be one guide that parents can use of, do I need to push more or do I need to take other steps like get outside tutoring or see how the school might be intervening if there is an issue like the child's not able to read fluently enough or is having difficulties in math or things like that.
Do you often see something of a feedback loop going on when a child starts having difficulty at school? Can that feeling of being overwhelmed lead to being overly anxious and that compounds problems and then begins to become exhibited in behavior at home?
I think you certainly can. You know, anxiety begets more anxiety. So when one part of your life is high anxiety, and then you start getting pressure in your other parts of life to also be performing at a level when you're already feeling overwhelmed, you're going to see that anxiety generalized to more settings. And so it certainly can affect home life. Anybody who has had a child that has been reluctant to engage in homework because they're academically stressed can certainly say, you know, to the point where they regret having to head home because they know they've got a three-hour battle ahead working over some sort of homework. And so then that way the anxiety is bleeding over from the school setting into home.
So what are some steps that a parent can take? Let's say, what is the first step? When a parent realizes that this is something other than being irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I was saying earlier, the first step, of course, is to reach out to the teachers and try to see what's going on and if they have any insight there. Some other things you can do is if your child is doing homework at home, you can maybe spot some of the issues they're having at school by some of their natural kind of behaviors. So if you see them continually getting distracted from their homework, you may notice that the TV is on in the background or that they have a radio playing. So that could show that there's some distractibility issues. If they, say, forgotten their needed materials at school or they wait till the last minute to do something, things we can do is to help them or model for them better ways to organize your schedule. And we can do that by creating visual reminders. So you have the good old standby, the week at a glance calendar, where at the maybe every Sunday you sit down and say, okay, what projects do you have due? When are they due? And put them down in the calendar. For those of you who are more tech savvy and like have smartphones, then of course there's calendar options there. And as opposed to just putting the due date of when that project's due, putting a reminder 2 to 3 days before that project is due so that there's an adequate amount of time for that child to go ahead and accomplish the task.
Is there evidence that social media in children's lives has added an additional channel of stress?
Well, I think certainly that there is a lot of interesting research coming out about social media and its impact on children. I think it's anybody who's looked at cyberbullying and some of those issues can certainly opine that there is additional stress to the use of social media. Not that we ever want to vilify social media. There's some positive aspects to it, but it certainly, I think, it tends to increase depression and loneliness rates. And then also you have what they call like FOMO, which is the fear of missing out. And so there's this pressure of, gee, what is Tommy doing now? Why can't I be doing the same fun stuff that he's doing? And somehow I'm not measuring up socially. So certainly anxiety can also be covered with that in addition to the academics.
I know that you like to suggest hands-on metaphors mm-hmm. as tools to teach how to prioritize work and break it down into achievable sequences. Tell us about that.
Well, I borrowed this from one of the readings that I – when I was looking at this topic. And the metaphor they've used, and I think it's really a nice one, is the idea of how you structure to get big projects done. And the way you do that is liken it to baking bread or a cake and how there are a recipe. And if you've ever followed a recipe for cooking, you know that you don't put all the ingredients in at once, and you know that there's a certain order for those ingredients. And if you go out of order for those ingredients, then you're not going to get usually a tasty pastry out of it, but rather something that's quite awful. And so using the metaphor of baking can help kids conceptualize the steps you need to take to complete larger projects that they may be assigned. So they know first they've got to do this step. And if they skip steps, just like in baking, or they try to go to the end, you're not going to get a product that you're proud of and that you feel accomplished with. But if you simply follow the directions and go in the time span that's outlined in the recipe, you can end up doing remarkable things like, you know, make a birthday cake. And so I think that metaphor, and sometimes depending on the age of your child, you may need to explain that metaphor a little bit more, maybe even make some cookies and then say, hey, we can eat them after you've started on the big project. So you make the metaphor very real for them and hopefully drives home the point that there is a reason that we try to break these down so that we can achieve and not get overwhelmed, which is what we're going for in trying to reduce children's anxiety.
It sounds like an early introduction to process.
Mm-hmm. I think definitely. You know, the understanding, and of course, they're going to be exposed to this in later math too, right? There is a process to come up with the right answer, the right product. And so starting early with that type of mentality, I think means that you're going to build your child's resilience, that they will not become overwhelmed by automatically thinking how awful it's going to be, but rather, I just need to sit down, I need to do a particular process, and if I do that, I'm going to be successful. And that's a really important message to send to kids.
So on the flip side of all of this, can stress be a good thing?
Yeah, I think stress has a bad name, probably because most of us only really think about it when it's hurting us. But there's this whole idea of what they call kind of a stress curve. It's an inverted curve, meaning that the middle of the curve is at the top. And what that basically states is if you have no stress in your life, then your performance is actually quite low, because if you think there's nothing riding on it, there's nothing to really motivate you, get the juices flowing that says, hey, I need to do well. So a moderate level of stress, and that's going to vary depending on the child, but a moderate level of stress gets you the motivation to complete things and to do things with a high level of accuracy. The problem is when you tip that moderate level of anxiety or stress over so that it starts going back down the curve as far as your performance. And that's where people usually identify things like toxic stress and acute stress kind of reactions.
Dr. Dan Florell is an associate professor at Eastern Kentucky University. He also has a private practice in Richmond, MindSci.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. The Lexington Philharmonic is in a time of transition as the orchestra searches for its next conductor and music director and the character and personality that that person will bring to the podium. We have interviewed 3 of 6 candidates for the position, and you'll find those conversations on our website, esweku.com. Next up is Enrico Lopez Yanez of Nashville. Greetings, Enrico.
Hi, great to speak with you.
So you'll be soon coming to Lexington for a very intense week of interviewing, meeting people, rehearsing, and then conducting. Are you ready for all this?
That's right. I'm actually very excited. I can't wait for the week. I'm looking forward to meeting everyone and meeting the orchestra, the community, and getting to create some beautiful music and learn a little bit more about the community there.
Well, let's find out a little bit about you. If you could tell us how music came into your life to begin with.
Of course. I was fortunate enough that actually music has always been in my life. Both of my parents are professional musicians. My father is an opera singer who's traveled internationally as an operatic tenor, and my mother is a concert pianist. So from a very young age, I grew up traveling with my parents, and really my nursery was the opera house. I grew up, you know, watching all of my dad's big productions, from whether it be opera houses in Europe to the Met to, you know, the Sydney Opera House in Australia. It was really just a spectacular experience getting to sit in on his rehearsals and watch the grandeur that was these big productions take place.
I was going to ask you how music became your life's work, but I think you just answered that question. It was just a natural, correct?
It really was. And I mean, it's such a, to be fed that at such a young age, it's just so thrilling and exciting that, of course, you know, I wanted to be a part of that world and participate in the way that both of my parents were able to. And thankfully enough, I've been able to do that, and I'm very appreciative of that.
So how would you say that this experience that you've had so far, particularly with that background, has shaped your musical personality?
Well, I will start by saying that I've always been drawn to the theatrical nature of our industry. And so I tend to lean towards and get excited about creating projects that are theatrical in nature or go beyond what our normal expectation of a concert experience might be and how it might be presented. And in addition to that, I think being around opera in particular taught me and captivated my interest in the collaborative aspect that is the opera house. There more than anywhere else, when you're working not only with choreographers and singers and dancers and an orchestra and administration as a conductor, you have to be flexible and you have to be collaborative and, you know, be it's not all about what you want. It's about a full cast and a full company's worth of interests and artistic opinions and musical, you know, languages that need to be heard. So I think that above all has been something that I've tried to carry through, whether it's in an opera pit or in front of an orchestra, is being collaborative and allowing the individuality of a group, of the particular musicians in a group, to speak and come to the front.
You are in Nashville, Music City, many, many genres. What are your thoughts about cultivating new audiences and picking up on what you just told us, innovating the concert experience?
Yeah, you know, here in Nashville, we're very fortunate to be at the sort of starting point or the home, you know, court for a lot of these artists of many genres, as you mentioned, and as a result have gotten to participate and work with artists of many, many genres and great musical diversity, which has been incredibly fun for me as a conductor. But outside of that, even just with normal orchestral concerts, we've done and created innovative projects. A program that started just a couple of years ago that I worked to develop was called Spirits of Summer, in which we took normal classical chamber music, but rather than playing it on stage in a normal setting, we actually converted the concert hall to a flat floor configuration, and the orchestra sat at the center of that, and the audience sat all around it. Well, they actually stood all around it because there were cocktail tables set up, and for each piece of music on that concert, we found a local barista to pair with that repertoire and create a custom cocktail paired to the music. So the baristas and I spoke about the music and cocktail pairings, and then at the end of the evening, the audience had the opportunity to vote on their favorite cocktail pairing with the music. So it's sort of a little cross-sensory experience for them.
Yeah, very immersive, huh?
That's right.
During this 2019-20 season, you've made appearances with the San Diego, Edmonton, and Detroit Symphonies, the Rochester Philharmonic, and the Sarasota Orchestra. You have also appeared with the Utah and Omaha Symphonies, as well as the Oklahoma City Philharmonic, and you are now the principal pops conductor of the Nashville Symphony. Why Lexington?
You know, I first went to Lexington a few years ago, actually. So I participated in a summer festival called the Prague Summer Nights Festival, which is run by John Nardolillo, who's the music director and conductor at UK. And he invited me to Lexington a couple years later to judge one of their concerto competitions. And I got to explore the city a little bit. And I just found it so beautiful and so charming in so many ways. And when the opportunity came for this position, I thought, gosh, it's so convenient to where I currently live, and it seems so rich with history and full of potential for music making that it just seems like a great fit.
Well, Enrico, if you would tell us a bit about the program that you will conduct when you're here in Lexington.
Absolutely. I think what is so fun about the program that we'll be presenting in February is that it really has a little bit of everything for everyone. We start off with a great piece, one of her most famous pieces by Jennifer Higdon called Blue Cathedral, in which she depicts this glass cathedral in the sky that the audience is supposed to be sort of walking through. And it has all sorts of neat special effects, from the brass playing on glass, crystal glasses. The piano is a prepared piano, so there are screws put into the piano to give all these extra special effects. And there are Chinese reflex bells that the orchestra musicians have to play. Really just neat, but very approachable contemporary piece of music. And from that, we go to something that's almost the complete opposite, which is a Beethoven piano concerto. And one of the ones from his later point in life, where you really hear a lot of sort of deep emotions and beautiful writing from a, at this point, much more experienced Beethoven rather than his early classical music. And then we wrap up the program coming from these sort of more light points of view to something that's rather dark in comparison, which is Dvorak's Seventh Symphony, which at this point in time is one of his most famous symphonies. The last three that he wrote are really sort of at the peak of his compositional writing. And it's just so beautiful and dark and rich in texture that it evokes so much emotion. So I think that pairing with the old and the new and that beautiful middle ground romantic writing of Dvorak's is just a really fun evening for the audience to come and enjoy.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that you're of course, conducting at the end of a very intense week here. A lot going on prior to that. What else is on your agenda for your week in Lexington?
Well, I'll be meeting with several of the local schools and youth orchestras in the area. I'll get an opportunity to meet, of course, members of the Philharmonics organizations, the board, the committee members, and hopefully, you know, get to see more of the community. One of my big interests is getting to learn more about the people that live in Lexington and what their hopes and goals for their orchestra are and the kinds of interests that they have and what they would like to see more and less of.
And before I let you go, talk to me a little bit about your philosophy about community engagement.
Absolutely. I think one of the big things is that for an orchestra should reflect its community and its community's interests. And we, as a bearer of culture, should help either, you know, reflect the community's interests or help the community resolve things or find ways to express itself and be there as, you know, the needs of the community develop. For some people, they seek music for emotional relief. Other people, for entertainment and fun and enjoyment, and orchestras should be flexible in adapting and growing and innovating in such a way that they are able to give back to their community all of the things that we need from an artistic perspective just for healthy souls as human beings.
Enrico Lopez-Yanez, a candidate to lead the Lexington Philharmonic, and he will conduct the program Blue Beethoven at the Singletary Center for the Arts on Friday, February the 21st. Thank you so much, Enrico.
Thank you.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.com on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.